Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
The world surrounds us with living color. From nature's green and browns and reds to the nursery's pastels, color affects us in culturally distinct ways. Today's guest has written a book about one color in a cultural context, blue, and its deep significance in Judaism. The famous Israeli poet known as Zelda, whose work often explores spirituality and mysticism, wrote a poem that is the ideal introduction to today's topic. The poem, called Blue Pomegranate, begins with this couplet: "A blue pomegranate is he who hides in his heart his fire, the tear of his secret, the word that burns his mouth, the sigh of his soul." Welcome to the Van Leer Institute series on ideas. I'm Renee Garfinkel, your host. I'm delighted to be speaking with Gadi Sagiv today about his beautiful new book, Jewish Blues, A History of a Color in Judaism. Gadi Sagiv is associate professor at the Department of History and Philosophy and Judaic Studies, the Open University of Israel. Among his earlier works is the book Chassidism, A New History, of which he was one of the co-authors. Gadi Sagiv, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Very happy to be here, Renee. Thanks for inviting me.
Let's start from the very beginning. What is the origin of the significance of the color blue in Judaism? How did it start?
Well, the origin of blue in Judaism seem to be in the Hebrew Bible. The Jews are requested to use not exactly blue, but some term, some material termed tchelet, which is associated with blue, to several commandments. Several of them, most of them are to be used in the temple and the tabernacle, but there is a personal commandment which Jews are requested to put a thread on their clothing. That's the Jewish origins, but as I show in the book, this was not a Jewish invention, because this color was used, or similar color were used, in other ancient cultures.
But you began your study of the color blue, or tchelet, not with the Bible, but with the 16th century. What was happening in the Jewish world at that time and in the world in general?
Yes, I started it as some kind of background in antiquity, but my book focuses in, the focus of my book is since the 16th century. The 16th century is actually what is called a part of the early modern period in history, which is the age of discoveries, which is the beginning the Renaissance, the European Renaissance, the scientific revolution began at that time. And also the discourse on colors increased during the 16th century, not in the context of Judaism, but more generally in, let's say, European context. And in Judaism, during the 16th century, there was also a very specific event, the expulsion from Spain and the emergence of the Jewish center, cultural and social center, in Safed, in the Ottoman Empire. And focus of my book is how the Jewish, let's say, Jewish discourse, religious discourse during the 16th century increased with regard to this color blue. It was very emphasized in the Jewish, in the Kabbalah, the Jewish mystical tradition. It was very emphasized in Jewish costumes in the Ottoman Empire. And of course, it corresponded with the increase of talking about colors in the surrounding societies.
But by that time, by the time the renewed interest in it in the 16th century or thereabouts, early modern period, the use of the color in ritual clothing and fringes and the prayer shawl had already disappeared. When and why did the use fade between biblical times and early modern times?
Yes, that's the connection between the Hebrew Bible and these 16th century developments. When Jews were requested to put a Jewish thread on their clothing, the rabbinic source of antiquity, the Tosefta and the Talmud requested that it would be made, that the bluish dye would be made from a secretion of a marine mollusk called the chilazon, which is in modern Hebrew it's termed as snail, but it's not the only possible translation. And this was actually the technique of making the Tyrian purple in antiquity by the Phoenicians and the Greeks and the Romans. It was a very prestigious dye made in antiquity. But as time during history, the knowledge of how to produce this dye was actually lost from various reasons, where restrictions by the rulers following the destruction of the temple, it was not used as much as it was used before. Jews actually lost the knowledge how to produce this color, and they continued to continue the Jewish ritual life without this color. It remained in the imagination. It did remain, and I show that in the book, that it even increased in the imagination. Color blue continued to be in mystical sources, but not in real lives. Only in the 19th century, it returned to the material, the Jewish material life, this specific mollusk-based bluish dye.
So tell us about what the color blue or bluish meant in Jewish mysticism.
I will not go into a comprehensive explanation of Jewish mysticism, but we can say that blue was, in a way, an object of contemplation. It was both a means to attain mystical experiences, and at the same time, the objective of those mystical experiences, the result, the experience itself. But blue also had not a mystical role, it also had a magical role. We know that blue in Mediterranean cultures is used against the evil eye, is believed to be powerful against the evil eye, and this notion also entered mysticism. It became a color that is both an object of contemplation, and at the same time, it is an object that can protect the believer. It's very useful to possess objects with a blue color because they protect the believer. Within the system of elements of powers of, let's say, a gradation of Jewish mysticism, of Kabbalah, of the Sefirot, blue is mostly associated with the lowest Sefira, Malchut or Shechina, which is the connection between the earthly realm and the divine realm. It is the connection for people to attain higher experiences, and it both protects the believers here on Earth.
So there is a relationship between Tchelet, the meaning of blue or bluish in Judaism, and the Chamsa, the ubiquitous Middle Eastern hand, which is a symbol of an amulet against an evil eye and is often, if not always, blue. Are you saying that there's a relationship between the two?
Yes, I said, I think there is, I argue that there's a relation. I show that there is a myth in the Zohar, in the Book of Splendor, one the major book of Jewish mysticism. It's a medieval book, but it was mostly developed, this myth developed in the 16th century, that some kind of personification of this Kabbalistic element, which is the Sefirat Malchut, actually is clothed with some kind of bluish garments that protects both the divine realm as well as the believers from the evil eye of the demonic forces. That is, I think that the Jewish Kabbalah actually imported this popular beliefs about, like the Chamsa, about the blue and the evil eye, and made it some kind of a dominant or a mystical belief in Judaism, in the Kabbalah.
And the biblical community, you mentioned that blue is something to meditate on. It's actually a biblical commandment to meditate on the blue in the fringes of the prayer shawl. And in your book, you talk about that is in relationship to a later idea, a recommendation to meditate on blue in a candle flame. So the connection between all those blues, talk a little bit about the connection between that, between the meditation on it, the protection value, and the religious meaning of it outside of mysticism, perhaps for messianism.
In the book, I presented several examples of meditating on blue and the positive results it has on the believer. For example, contemplating on the candle flame, a person can see specifically in the bluish flame, the bluish color in the flame, can connect the believer to those upper realms, putting on contemplating on the bluish thread, on the tzitzit, on this fringe, can actually protect the person who does so. And even and when a person contemplates on these bluish objects, let's say, or phenomena on Earth, can bring him elevate himself to a mystical experience that actually can bring him to kind of personal redemption and even contribute to a more general messianic redemption. And the messianic aspect is also comes with the entire renewal of the usage of this blue color, but I guess we will get back to it later.
Right.
In the personal domain, every personal experience of elevation to the upper realms is a kind of a moment of redemption, personal messianism, let's say.
When I read ideas of mysticism, I can't help but understand them in part simply psychologically. It's a consequence of my training. And I was very interested to learn in the book that that blue is also the color of contradiction or the inclusion of opposites. I think the phrase you use is the way the sea gathers water, that it's somehow blue is so comprehensive and inclusive that it can reconcile or include things that are apparently contradictory. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it actually reminded me a little of some Zen Buddhist ideas.
Yes, that's interesting, because blue is actually when I wrote that blue is associated with the lowest divine
emanation.
Power, the Shekhinah, the emanation, the Shekhinah, Malchut, as it's called. The Shekhinah itself has kind of dual role. It's on the one hand, it protects the Jews from and escorts them in their travels in the world, in their exile. But on the other hand, when Jews don't obey God, it is a way to punish them. So this dual action of protection and punishment exists also in the blue. And it's very visual that Zohar says that this thread is, on the one hand, is a protecting, covering garment, but at the same time, it's look like something that in which we can hit the Jews to snap. It's kind of a tool that can punish a stick or even some kind of snapshot.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Yeah, the idea that the same element, the same factor, the same aspect of the divine image and force is both protective and can be harmful. I think that's frequently the case with any sort of power, especially ones that are close to us, like fire, for example.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, this blue. The blue is also is a color of both fire and water, and fire is also good and can be good and bad, and the same as water can. We cannot live without water, but water can drown us as well. It's both of them as are have dual roles of good and bad for people.
And today we think about, well, we, that is people in the West, think of blue as a calming color. It's considered to be tranquil psychologically, the visual blue, but of course blue in music is sad if you play the blues. So what's your understanding of the different emotional aspects of colors in different contexts? How does that work?
I think that color does not have an objective existence. It depends, and that is what I tried to emphasize in my book. It depends on the specific social and cultural context in which it is used. Blue can be, of course, calming, and blue can be, for example, mysticism, an object of mystical contemplation, which can be very calming, but it also associated with color blue is very close to black. And this is a color of even mourning and death. So for me, since I started to be interested by colors, I actually departed from these very definite opinions about specific colors. I think that every colors can arise positive and negative emotions in different times. I love blue very much, of course, but I know it can be, I now know that it can be a color that is very much associated with darkness and death at the same time. So I don't have a clear answer about that. And blue, as a matter of fact, is considered to be very popular and calming in Western culture, but I don't think it was so in other cultures. As I showed in the book, in, let's say, Mediterranean cultures, it was considered to be, although protective, but also very threatening. People with blue eyes, which are not very common in the Mediterranean cultures, were viewed as very dangerous or threatening. So it was also a threatening color, not also only a calming one.
So essentially, if I understand what you're saying, is cultures project meaning onto different colors in their language and in their cultural styles. You mentioned in the book that in the Ottoman Empire, only Muslims could wear green, for example. When we know more recently how color in clothing was used to ostracize or mark different people, foreigners or other undesirables. So how was color symbolism understood in, let's say, the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, which you focus on the early modern period?
Yes, in the Ottoman Empire, the favorite color for Muslims, for the ruling groups, were the bright colors. These were, of course, green was considered the color of Islam until today, and it was the favorite color by the Ottomans. So Jews and also other non-Jews were forbidden to wear green colors, clothing with the color green.
Non-Muslims
were forbidden to wear, I'm sorry. But there were also internal, let's say, restrictions. The color red was considered by Jews to be of negative meaning. It was associated with Esav. It was associated with the blood. It was associated with the Christians, with other non-Jews. It was associated with the blood and impurity. And Jews actually distanced themselves from red. So during the 16th and 17th century, Jews, if they obeyed to external and internal restrictions, actually had some kind of very limited, let's say, palette of colors to choose from. They were actually directed to or led to use these dark colors of, in the range of blue, black, violet, let's say, but not green and not red. And also, for example, in other, the color yellow was considered in other, in European context, to be a color of prostitution, for example. That was also, people wanted to distance themselves. So I'm not saying that Jews wore only blue and black colors, but this was some kind of safe preference to wear for Jews during that those periods.
Okay. All right. And you do examine in the book, although we won't go into it now, that there were economic influences on color symbolism, as in the early modern period, the international trade, global trade, included various dyes, which were invented or became widely available. So that also influenced the change. But listeners will have to read the book to find out more about that. finally, Gadi, back in 2013, there was a conference that was convened in honor of the grandfather of Israel's current president, Herzog, who did research in rediscovering the authentic dye. And that was very controversial in some quarters. So tell us about that controversy. Why going back to or rediscovering the original authentic dye for this color, Tchelet, could be so controversial? And how is it viewed today?
Well, as we said, Jews used to wear Tchelet based on the so-called snail during in antiquity, but the knowledge of to produce this dye was lost, and Jews avoided using or could not use this dye for centuries. And but at the end of the 19th century and during the 20th century, there was a new, let's say, movement of renewing this dye, and this caused a controversy in among Orthodox Judaism, because this seemingly renewal of an authentic commandment was actually breaking from the Orthodox tendency to avoid such kind of innovations. And this is the controversy. Some Jews wanted to be more authentic and return and restore the biblical past, but others objected to this notion of authentic Judaism and wanted to keep Judaism as it was during the 18th and 19th century. That's actually going back to renewing the ancient tradition was actually breaking from with the tradition of not having any innovations in the Jewish religion, in the Jewish halachic system. So that was the basic controversy. And there was also a smaller controversy about what should be the exact way to prepare this this dye. But this conference actually was a celebration of the group of those who wanted to renew the uses of this biblical blue. And today there are various groups. I think the majority still avoids using this blue, but there's a significant minority who uses particularly in Israel, but also abroad.
It's quite an interesting philosophical, religious dilemma that you describe, because it's in effect, it seems like the perfect is the enemy of the good. That is, after many, many centuries, we're able to rediscover the original, the real thing. But then even if it's authentic, it breaks with the tradition of all these centuries of Jewish practice. So it's I guess it was a question of authority. What is the authority? Is it tradition or is it fact? Would you say that was the question?
Yes, that was one of the questions, whether the whole project of renewing the biblical dye introduced scientific arguments. And now there comes the question, who says how to prepare this biblical dye? Are these the scientists or the rabbis? So the introduction of scientists and argument is actually a threat to certain to a tradition of relying on rabbis as And also there was a tradition of not using the dye. This is very paradoxical. What tradition should we prefer? The biblical tradition of using blue or the modern tradition of not using it? Here we have competing tradition. Here we have questions of science and religion, which we have questions of authority, rabbis or scientists or Orthodox Jews who are also scientists. Who's in charge here? I think it raises many questions.
Who's in charge here? That's a very good question for us to stop on. The book is Jewish Blues, A History of a Color in Judaism. Thanks so much for sharing your very beautiful book with us today, Gadi.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed being here.
And thanks to our researcher, Bela Pasikov.